Hi everyone, thanks for joining us for our NEA BPD podcast. My name is Andrea Gold, and I'm delighted to be interviewing tonight's speaker, Dr. Blaise Aguirre, who will talk to us tonight about behaviorism, reinforcement, and punishment as essential knowledge in treating BPD. Because of our interview format tonight, this podcast does not have any handouts. And now it's my pleasure to introduce Blaise, who is a child and adolescent psychiatrist at McLean Hospital, where he has been since the year 2000, and is currently an assistant professor at Harvard Medical School. Blaise specializes in dialectical behavior therapy, or DBT, as well as mentalization-based therapy, or MBT, to treat borderline personality disorder and related conditions. He is the founding medical director of the 3 East Continuum of Care at McLean, which uses DBT to treat high-risk, self-endangering behaviors and BPD in adolescents. He has also written several books, and a few of them I want to mention because they're particularly relevant to our podcast. These books include Borderline Personality Disorder in Adolescence, Mindfulness for Borderline Personality Disorder, and Coping with BPD, DBT and CBT Skills to Soothe the Symptoms of Borderline Personality Disorder. And I highly recommend checking those out if you're listening. Finally, I want to mention that Blaise is recognized internationally as a leader in training, teaching, and speaking about BPD in adolescents. Case in point, he's joining us tonight fresh from a 2-week speaking tour with 10 talks in, get this, 3 continents. So thanks for joining us, and welcome, Blaise.
Thank you so much for having me. I love the work of the NEA BPD. I think just wonderful leaders in the field of destigmatizing the condition and increasing awareness. So thanks for having me on.
I'm really glad, Blaise, that you mentioned stigma, because I think the stuff you're going to teach us tonight is really an important piece to talking about BPD without stigma. That's something that behaviorism offers us. So let's get started. To orient you as our listeners, we're going to start off by talking about the who, what, where, when, and why, and how of behaviorism in treating BPD. So as far as the what, Blaise, in a nutshell, what is behaviorism?
So I tend to give these long-winded answers if people know me for that, but because I, you know, didn't know anything much about behaviorism until I had a long chat with Marsha Linehan about this. I had always considered behavior just to see, to be the things that I could see someone doing. So if I saw someone kick a ball, then that would be the behavior that they were doing, was kicking a ball. She talked about this concept called radical behaviorism, which was anything that the organism did. So not only did it include things like kicking the ball, but it included emotions that they felt and thoughts that they had. So it was ultimately anything that the organism or the human being did, whether you were able to see it or not. So so it includes physical behaviors, emotions, and thoughts.
Excellent. So if you're introducing behaviorism in a therapy session, for example, let's say it's a teen with BPD and their parents, mm-hmm. How would you expand on this?
Yeah, so what I would say is that in any given moment, parents and the young people with BPD are seeing some sort of phenomenon, which is let's say the child is shutting down and going to their room. So the behavior that the parents see is going to the room, and but what's missed in that is that the parent only sees the behavior of going to the room, but does not see the behavior of thought or the behavior of emotion that is also happening at the same time, whereas the adolescent can experience the emotions and the thoughts at that time. But because the parents often don't see thoughts and emotions, they might attribute some type of intentionality to that which the adolescent isn't experiencing. So what I want them to do is to start paying attention. So for the adolescent to start paying attention to their thoughts and emotions as well as the behaviors, and for the parents to go beyond just the going to the room behavior and get curious about what else is going on at the same time in terms of thoughts and emotions.
And I like that, get curious instead of jumping to conclusions.
Right. Well, I think that the other part of it is that rather than just automatically coming to conclusions, and that by paying careful attention to all of those things, that the reason why it's so important is that if we're going to change things, we have to understand all its component parts, including the thoughts and emotions that show up at the same time.
Excellent. So before we get into more detail with the what, I want to ask you some questions about the why. Why care about behaviorism? So how would you explain, let's say, the same family, a teenager and parents, what's the rationale for learning about behaviorism? You know, say a little bit more about what's in it for them. What do they get out of it?
Well, let's just say that a family has two children, say even twins, and the behavior that the parents see is, I don't know, say smoking weed. To the parent that's observing these two children smoking weed, they might just say, okay, well, that's the behavior that the parent does not like. But for one child, the reason that they're smoking weed is because it sort of really chills them out so that they're able to do their homework. It's not otherwise interfering with their life. They're getting good grades and they've got great friends. But for the other child doing exactly the same behavior, maybe they've been bullied at school or maybe they're having intense emotions. And the reason that they're smoking weed is so that they don't feel those emotions or to get away from, to avoid experiencing the bullying experience. So that by understanding everything that's going on, even though the behavior of smoking marijuana might seem the same under both circumstances, in one situation it could be typical behavior, and in the other situation it could be very problematic behavior. So the reason why is that you want to understand exactly what's going on, and to treat them as identical problems would be inaccurate and not helpful, because in one you might really have to be concerned about thinking about what else is the kid going to do if they're being bullied, and the other one, you know, you might not focus as much on that behavior.
Well, and it also sounds like if the teen is using smoking weed as a way of solving the problem, they're not having opportunities to learn other ways of dealing with the problem too.
Exactly. So that by better defining it from a behavioral perspective that includes thoughts and emotions, and understanding it, then you can think about other ways of solving it other than just weed.
How about motivating clinicians, your students, and even our audience members to motivate them to learn behaviorism? What's in it for these people?
Well, I think that one of the things that often happens when we get new clinicians on our unit is that they've been trained in maybe pure CBT, pure behaviorism, in terms of maybe classical conditioning or something like that, where these sort of some event is paired with some behavior, or they've been trained in an analytic orientation where they make interpretations and assumptions about people's behavior, so that if we automatically go to the reason that this person is doing this is to upset me, or the reason that they're doing this is to seek attention, is that they come to conclusions which may not be accurate conclusions and can in turn end up hurting the very people that they want to work with. So that by slowing that down and getting a bigger picture of what's actually going on. Both the clinician becomes more accurate in assessment, and the adolescent or the child will feel more understood because the clinician's getting a more accurate picture, and that enhances the relationship between the two as well.
So it actually sounds like the rationale for family members and for treaters in using a behavioral approach is really parallel. Is that what you're saying?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. I think, and I think that the transaction between that as the child or the teen feels that the clinician or the parent is making more of an attempt at really understanding fully what is going on, they're also more likely to share more information, because often we get kids who just shut down because they say, you know, they tell their parent one thing and then the parent goes off and maybe reacts in ways that are inconsistent with how the child is feeling. And so they feel punished by the parent's reaction and then begin to shut down and not share more information. Parents often want to know, how do I get more information from my kids? And this idea of really staying curious without automatically assuming that they know what's going on for the kid is actually a key component of getting the child to share more information.
When parents do this more, would you say that the kids feel more validated?
I mean, certainly you're not going to make the situation worse. And in many situations, the kids feel more validated because they feel that the parent is being curious without coming to automatic conclusions. It's a much better style of interaction with a child than the ones that are reactive and assumptive.
It's an interesting point for clinicians, because I think we're often trained to think about behaviorism as a way of changing behavior, but it almost sounds like you're talking about a way of accepting, understanding, and validating it too. So that's pretty interesting to hear.
Well, I think that the reason is that if you're trying to understand a cake, and then you understand that it's one of the components is flour, and you say, okay, great, I'm going to make a cake with flour. But then you're not going to have a complete assessment of what a cake is, because you have to slow down and understand that there's all these other ingredients and make sure that you have it all before you can make a cake. In the same way, it's like if you're trying to understand a behavior in context, understanding just one part of it would be incomplete and imprecise if you haven't spent enough time kind of breaking it down into its parts.
I like that a lot, because it's like if your goal is to make a delicious, sweet cake, all you focus is on the flour, you may get a bland piece of bread.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Right, exactly.
So a couple of weeks ago, we had a podcast that was actually on mentalization-based treatment. Dr. Efren Blyberg titled his podcast, Mentalizing, Learning to Trust, Are These Active Ingredients in Treating BPD? I'm curious, Blaise, would you say that behaviorism is, clearly I think it's an active ingredient, but would you say it's a necessary one in treating BPD regardless of the therapy or not necessarily?
Do you mean trusting?
No. So I was using that as an example of he was labeling the trust piece as an active ingredient in the treatment.
Mm-hmm.
And for your topic of behaviorism, you think of it as an active ingredient and even a necessary ingredient for treating BPD.
Well, having used lots of methodologies to try to sort of understand BPD, to me it's been, you know, behaviorism and mindfulness as well as validation have been the three most important aspects of treating BPD. I think I am a better clinician because of it. Is anything necessary? But for me, it's it has been a necessary component. Mm-hmm. And I think that, I mean, I know that many other forms of therapy don't consider it in a very manifest way, but I think it's been one of the component parts, and certainly for me a necessary part.
You have a unique perspective because you have expertise in DBT where behaviorism is exclusive, but also other psychotherapies where it's not.
So let's kind of delve
more into the what of behaviorism. And here's where I want you to talk a little bit about the science and teach our listeners what are some of the basic principles and the must-know definitions and terms.
Yeah. I think that the ones that, behaviorism has got, 60, 70 years of kind of theory behind it. But the ones that I think for me are the most important are the concepts of reinforcement. And reinforcement is anything that you do that increases the likelihood that a behavior is going to happen, or at least maintain a behavior happening. So, something like positive reinforcement is doing something that gets you a result that you want. You get into your car, you either push your button or you turn the key and the car starts. So you're being
An example for me, when I was doing kind of a lousy job at parenting, my toddler threw a tantrum, wouldn't let me put her seatbelt on, and I showed her an Elmo video. And she ended up doing more and more tantrums because it got her what she wanted, the Elmo video.
That's a really, really important example, and we'll get to that in a second. Because I think that there's behaviorism happening both ways there.
Absolutely.
Negative reinforcement is when you take something that is aversive away so that it increases the behavior. So, for instance, when you get into your car, you hear that beeping sound, and then you put your seatbelt on, you take away the sound, which is annoying to you, and so it increases the behavior of putting on the seatbelt. And then there's the idea of punishment, which is trying to reduce a behavior through the application of an aversive in order to reduce. We don't use that much punishment. We use some punishment, mostly in the context of natural consequences. That when rather than when I grew up in South Africa at a Catholic boys' school, I used to get they used corporal punishment. So we would get caned for infractions. All it did was teach us how to be sneakier, because it didn't really teach us much of anything, as opposed to natural consequences that when, people speed, they get punished by getting a speeding ticket if they get caught. And, over time, hopefully that behavior would go down. So the idea of reinforcement, which is what are the behaviors that you want to see increased, and what are the behaviors that you want to see decreased? And then the concept of extinction, which is not reinforcing some behavior so that behavior then doesn't continue. But if, for instance, going back to your example of your toddler, if every time, she had a tantrum, you put on an Elmo video, so now she's teaching you, she is reinforcing your behavior, and it's negative reinforcement because by her stopping crying, your behavior of putting on the Elmo video is increased. But now if you decide, wait a second, I don't want my toddler to be watching Elmo until age 16.
Good news, I am proud to say I did some extinction.
Excellent.
But there was extinction burst along the way. So tell our listeners what an extinction burst is.
Right. So that when you realize that you've been reinforcing a behavior, and you decide you're going to withdraw the reinforcer, in this case the Elmo video, you're going to have an extinction burst, which is that because she has learned that all she that, and again, it's not a conscious understanding. It's just that the behavior of tantruming led to you putting on the Elmo video. So she has learned over time that the tantrum got the Elmo video. So when you remove the Elmo video, you're going to see a burst in this behavior. She's going to tantrum for a lot longer. And then one of two things is going to happen. Either you're going to give in and put on an Elmo video, in which case you've reinforced tantruming at a much higher level, or eventually she's going to realize that tantruming no longer works, and then that behavior will be extinguished over time.
I like how you said that so clearly. I think this is really helpful for our listeners, and I think this comes back to stigma and how you just said these behaviors are learned and they work. It's not a matter of people being manipulative or kind of trying to hurt other people. It's that it works for them.
Well, that's right, and I think it's because we tend to judge behavior. Because let's just say that a child is trying to learn what 1 + 1 is, and you know, they say 2, and then you reinforce that through, hey, well done, you got that right, and then what's 1 + 1? That's 2, great. And so you reinforce it over time. Now, and then the test comes, they say, what's 1 + 1? 2, and then they get an A on the test or whatever it is. But let's just say that they started to get variable responses. So like sometimes you would say 1 + 1 is 7, or 1 + 1 is 3, or so you started to get variable answers to that question. The person then wouldn't know what to do. And it would be really confusing. They wouldn't know how to answer the question. So the thing is that, I mean, you could say, okay, well, that's trivial. 1 + 1 is 2. That's trivial. But the principles remain, and that is that we want to be consistent in terms of reinforcing the behavior that we want, which is, in this case, would be getting the right answer or not having a child having a tantrum because they're not watching Elmo. Now, if you were to say the person is being manipulative because they got 1 + 1 is 2, because that's the answer that you want to get, but it's also the correct answer, they are being effective. But people often feel manipulated, even though it's not necessarily an intention to manipulate. And people, it's very important to make the distinction that the fact that you feel manipulated wasn't necessarily the intention of the other person. And now it's possible that they did want to manipulate, but in many cases, if they are being manipulative, they're not very, very effective manipulators because they end up in psychiatric hospitals. So you know, who'd want that if I was a good manipulator? And the other thing is, good manipulators, if someone's a good manipulator, you don't know you've been manipulated. So I think that the idea of manipulation is actually not a helpful one. I once in Grand Rounds actually pulled up a Google news site and said, you know, because people think that some colleagues have said manipulative is not a judgment, and I put the term manipulative in the news search engine, and there was not a single good thing that came up with manipulative. I mean, it was people doing awful things, and so that's the other part of it, that in terms of persistence of stigmatizing people with BPD.
So as a clinician, I think we often run into colleagues who will kind of make quick judgments like this and call either behaviors of people with BPD or even the people themselves manipulative. I think you just gave a very thoughtful answer. Now, let's say this is a context where you don't have as much time. Do you have any tips for clinicians or just people in the world who want to bring down the stigma? Is this a case where you would just ignore it, or what's something you could say that would be effective?
Well, I don't, you know, it's interesting because if you wanted to, you know, just kind of not react to the concept of manipulative, but I think it's been, you know, and try to extinguish them using that term. I actually spend more time talking about that because I think it is so stigmatizing. And when else do we use that? In what other kind of context do we say that the asthmatic is being, the person with asthma is being manipulative? Do we say the person with diabetes is being manipulative, with cancer is being manipulative? Why are we judging these behaviors? It's just, you know, a behavior that's been reinforced over time. And that, you know, if in fact the parent wants to change the child's behavior, are they in turn being manipulative as well?
Mm-hmm.
And maybe they are being manipulative because they're withholding a reinforcer or something like that. Is that being manipulative? So I just think that we just have to think about how has this behavior been reinforced over time. Now, again, I don't want to say that it doesn't, that a person doesn't say, I know that if I say this, I'm going to get this kind of response. But what I'm saying is, it's infinitely rarer than we think about it. So I do think that it's important because the term, I mean, if I were to call you manipulative, you'd sort of think, wait a second, it could feel like an assault. So I just think that we need to remove non-clinical terms from description of psychiatric illness.
And it's not only you gave examples like an asthmatic or someone with asthma, someone with cancer, but if you also think about different types of mental illnesses, I'm not sure I hear manipulative come up all that much other than BPD, or at least not as frequently with other types of mental illness, like anxiety disorders or depression.
Exactly. And it's not clinically descriptive. It's not, I mean, if you say someone has hypertension, that has definition. If someone is hypoglycemic, it's got a definition. If someone has major depression, we can define it in terms of criteria. But there's a lot of terms that are used in borderline personality disorder that don't have, that aren't part of the clinical description and don't have, aren't sort of precisely defined. So
I think I remember you talking about provocative as another one of those terms. Am I remembering that right?
Yeah. So I mean, I just think a lot of these, like provocative, gamey, attention seeking. I mean, people used to think that a lot of self injury was attention seeking, but we find that it's only in about 7% of cases that people are doing it to get the attention of others. But there's an automatic assumption that it's attention seeking. So, even things like promiscuous, it's interesting, you know, if it were being used equally between men who are promiscuous and women who are promiscuous, then, you know, perhaps, but still, even promiscuity in and of itself has a judgment associated with it, and it's used differentially between men and women. Women tend to be called promiscuous more than men are, and so I just think that we have to be more precise in terms of how we use these terms.
Absolutely. So going backwards to just how you were defining the must-know definitions of behaviorism and talking to us about positive and negative reinforcement, extinction, and punishment, let's have you give us an example of behavior and its kind of learning history for an individual with BPD that involves a self-injurious or suicidal behavior. So I want you to kind of spell this out. Applying behaviorism so we can kind of understand what's been leading to and maintaining the behavior. And then after that, I want to ask you some questions about how to treat it.
Okay, so let's just say that a person's been is because of their own genetics and temperament that they're a highly emotional person. And that they live in an environment where when the behavior of high emotionality shows up, then people do one of two things. Either they really lean in and pay very careful attention to what's happening, or they find the behavior of high emotionality very annoying and unwarranted and then leave the person. Okay, so what happens is, let's just say that that person actually wants people to be close to them. In the first situation, the one where they lean in, the person might learn that over time, all they have to do is continue to self-injure because people are going to lean in, and then they're going to get what they want. But then the problem is that they learn that they might learn that that's the only way to get people to pay attention. In the second situation, let's say they self-injure, and then people find it, or they have high emotionality, and then people leave them, abandon them, or just don't want anything to do with them. So then what happens is that the person might try to sort of regulate that high emotional state because they don't want people abandoning them. And let's say that they discover that when they cut themselves, the level of emotional suffering goes way down, even if it's just for a few minutes. If by doing that, by getting their emotional state lowered, then people don't leave them, then what's happened is that cutting has been reinforced by people not leaving them. And also cutting has reduced the amount of emotional suffering. So that in these situations, there's a lot of behaviorism happening here. They've been punished for having high emotions because people have left them. They have found a solution that by self-injuring, the behavior of self-injury reduces the amount of emotional suffering, and that it's reinforced because people then don't need them. So you'd see a lot of reinforcement at play there, or a lot of behaviorism at play there.
So when you're talking about, let's say, this example with a client, would you recommend getting really precise with positive and negative reinforcement, or do you kind of keep it at the level that you just described to us?
Yeah, it depends also on the ability of the client to be able to understand these concepts. But what I try to point out is in dialectical behavior therapy, we use a lot of chain analysis of behavior to show, the context that the behavior took place in, all the antecedents, all the things that came before the behavior, and then all the consequences of the behavior. So I'll show how, that if self-injury led to a reduction of suffering, it was, the consequence of self-injury was a reduction in the suffering state, so it's negatively reinforced. Then the other question is that in the short term, there's that negative reinforcement. However, it may have later consequences, so that when people find out, they don't like it, they lose trust in the person, or they themselves feel guilty for having done that. So I'll just show the chain of what happens in the very short term and what happens in the longer term, so that they can begin to understand these concepts. For some people, they're a little bit complicated to understand, and I'll just maybe use the term reinforcement or rewarding or beneficial. But I want them to understand that every behavior has a consequence, and to start paying attention to what the consequence is, whether positive or negative.
So you said you would teach people every behavior has a consequence. Mm-hmm. Would you also kind of talk about causes, like every behavior having a cause?
Yeah, I mean, I think every behavior, but the problem with causes is that every cause has a cause. And I mean, if you want to go back far enough, you can blame the Big Bang for everything, because that was the ultimate cause of everything. Everything happened after that. But I'm saying because if you get too caught up in causes, you could say, well, it's because my mother yelled at me. Well, why did your mother yell at her? Well, because she grew up in a household where people yelled at them. Why did she grow up in a household where people yelled at them? You can keep on going further back. But if you can understand that some of the immediate, somebody didn't call you, and in the context, now, why didn't that person call you? We might not know why that person didn't call, but even that had causes. But that it had, them not calling you had an impact, and how are you going to deal with the impact, even if you don't know the causes of why the person didn't call you? And how are you going to understand the impact? So I think that understanding in kind of immediate causes might be helpful, because maybe you can change some of those. Like, you know, if a person didn't call because they never charged their phone at night, then you could say, oh, that seems to happen a lot. Why don't you start charging your phone earlier in the day so that you'll always have charge? But I think that sometimes trying to get too much into the reasons why people have done something, because all those whys have whys as well, you know, can get a little tricky.
And I imagine that could also derail a lot of what happens next if you go back and back in time, like you were saying. So you're much more precise and thorough when looking at consequences.
I think so, because I think that there's much more immediate information. And I think that the other thing is that you can always understand more what are the consequences for yourself, and even some of them interpersonally. But if you're trying to understand why somebody didn't do something, why didn't they show up on time for your party? Well, I mean, it starts to get a little bit diffuse, because you'd have to understand what was happening for that person that they didn't show up on time. But maybe it's because, you know, their Uber driver showed up late. Well, why did the Uber driver show up late? Maybe there's something going on in the Uber driver's life. I mean, there's a lot of there are a lot of variables to try to understand, and you know, it's very hard to go back in time and change it. But what you can do, of course, is to validate how sad it is that the person didn't show up on time for your party, without necessarily getting too caught up in reasons why. Because often, the other part of it is that when people go back in time and think about reasons why, it's the reasons they come up with are often very negative reasons, rather than, you know, oh, they showed up late at my party because they wanted to buy me the perfect present, is rarely the reason that they come up with. It's often because I'm, you know, because they don't want me, because they don't like me. So I spend less time. I do spend some time trying to understand the context, but less time trying to understand the reason why.
This is a really important point, take-home point, I think, for our clinicians and practical applications. So far you've really given us a clear and helpful explanation of how we can use behaviorism, reinforcement, and punishment to understand behaviors and symptoms of BPD. Let's switch over to talking about how you now apply these in your interventions. Mm-hmm. So kind of give us some recommendations about how you would use positive and negative reinforcement and natural consequences in treatment.
Mm. So I, you know, I also try to make a little bit of. I don't make that many distinctions between treatment and not treatment, because I think it's in some sense it's life. It's not that I do certain things just with clients and not with colleagues and those kinds of things and other types of interactions, because I do think about reinforcement when I'm dealing with colleagues, or you know, if I give a talk and, you know, people like the talk, then I think about, then that's also reinforcing for me, so that the principles are applying to me whether I'm in treatment or not, whether I'm using treatment or not. So just broadly speaking, that these the behaviorism that play within the therapeutic context and even in just life. So
it's really an all-in life philosophy for you.
I think so. I mean, I it is. I mean, not, it's, I, and maybe I don't think. I mean, it's just become part of the way that I live. That, and so it's much more second nature now than sort of asking myself what's being reinforced or what isn't being reinforced. But I think I'm aware of it a lot more, just because I think that way a lot more. But getting back to how I use it in treatment is that I really try to understand behavior in the context. So, okay, so somebody tells me that something has happened, or that they have done a certain behavior. I try to understand and whether the behavior is a thought, a physical behavior, an emotion. What is the benefit to the person for doing that behavior? And if we think about it in terms of, you know, self-injury, that maybe they get some sort of immediate relief straight after having self-injured. But what about a thought like, I'm a terrible person? Well, then I wonder, what is the benefit to having that thought? Because I have yet to meet a terrible person with borderline personality disorder. I'm not saying that they're not out there, but I haven't met such a person. But they're thinking that they're terrible people. So why have that thought? Now, you can say, well, I don't choose to have that thought, but I would argue that there is some decision-making, that you can come to a conclusion that you're a terrible person, but you can also come to a conclusion that you're a person that has experienced a life of suffering and that you don't have to experience life of suffering anymore. Often the conclusion is, I'm a terrible person because I don't have any friends. But you can do things also that can change you not having friends, for example. I mean, and it's difficult. I'm not saying it's an easy thing to do. But what I do is I take any behavior that I see that the person brings into therapy, and then I want to understand the context. Where were you? So, for example, we see a lot of negative self-thinking or a lot of self-injury or a lot of maybe taking too many pills later on at night than first thing in the morning. Actually, it rarely happens first thing in the morning. Well, why is that? So you want to understand the context, and maybe it's been an exhausting day. Maybe you should have been in bed earlier, and maybe there's use of other substances. So you want to understand all the things that are happening around the time the behavior shows up and then what the consequence of the behavior is, so that the person becomes much more aware of why they're doing something.
I like how you brought up the context. That's actually one of my last questions about the five W's was where. So you explicitly point out context and use that in forming your solution.
Mm-hmm.
So let's ask you now about other ways that you might use behaviorism. So what about with working with parents and teens? Do you ever coach parents to change consequences or reinforcers, and what would that look like?
Yeah, I think that it's almost central to doing dialectical behavior therapy with families is looking at any behavior that happens, especially transactionally, between parent and child, and looking at the context. And then looking at the consequences. So let's just say, for example, that, you know, all the fights tend to happen in the evening when everybody's back at home, exhausted after a long day at school and work. Well, maybe the idea is changing the context. So saying, okay, we're going to leave all important discussions to Saturday morning when everybody's had a good night's sleep and is well rested. So you can start to change the context and see if that changes those kinds of interactions. Or alternatively, that by let's just say that every time the child self-injures, they're punished for having self-injured, so that the consequence of self-injury is punishment. But all that does is, let's say, for example, makes the self-injury worse because now they feel that they're terrible people, and so they're going to they believe that they will punish themselves for having self-injured, and the reaction of their parents by self-injuring more in order to punish themselves. So you might actually get a situation where you're making things worse. So maybe in that situation, rather than the parents yelling at the kid, maybe there would be some curiosity. Maybe there would be catching the isolation, earlier on so that they can have a discussion before the self-injury takes place. Maybe there can be recognizing when a child isn't self-injuring, catching them being good, so to speak, or catching behavior that you want and saying, hey, look, you know, self-injury seems to be going down. Why don't we go and, go out for dinner or do something nice that the child might want to do. So I think that, but I also get them to really pay a lot of attention to thought emotions as well as the manifest behavior so that they can understand the topography, the shape of the behavior a lot more between them.
So thinking about the word punishment, sometimes people who self-harm, people with PPD, will say that they do it as punishment when you ask them about it. So how do you talk about that and target it within the framework of behaviors?
Well, there's an inherent paradox in this, which I point out, and that is this. If we think about the concept of punishment, people get punished for doing something that society considers as wrong or maybe a crime. So, you know, you rob a bank and then you get punished by going to jail. So you have to suffer the consequence of having done that. So often, sometimes they'll tell me, well, I'm a terrible person and I need to be punished. So then I say, okay, but why? What does self-injury do? It says, well, you know, it provides relief when I cut myself as a form of punishment. I say, well, okay, but if you're supposed to be punished and you're supposed to be suffering, and the self-injury takes the suffering away, how is that punishment? So there's an inherent paradox, and I think it's a narrative that they often tell themselves, but in fact, it's not accurate, because what's happening is that there's suffering that is going on, and they found that that self-injury causes relief from that suffering. And so if you get into emotions, then it's much more understandable. As opposed to, you know, flagellation, self-flagellation in you know, ancient Christianity, where people would cause intentional harm in order to atone for their sins, but then they would feel the pain tremendously. Often when self-injury is used as punishment, the people with BPD don't feel the pain, so it wouldn't be consistent with punishment in that case.
What if someone were to describe it to you in that latter example, that it's like an atonement? How would you address that?
Well, I think, first of all, I mean, a lot of research shows that people with BPD have a different experience of pain. So that in highly emotional states, the experience of pain is different from what it would be like when they weren't in highly emotional states. But the other question then is, I would say, I would actually want a better, a more precise, more accurate kind of understanding of this whole punishment concept, because what is it that they have done that deserves punishment? It's, as I say, this concept that they're evil, that they're awful people deserving punishment is not because they've gone around hurting little children or robbing banks or stealing or damaging other people with any kind of intentionality, but because they're suffering, they come to the conclusion that they're terrible people. And so rather than saying, I am suffering and suffering is caused and I can change my experience by certain behavioral practices, including mindfulness, behavioral activation, and things like that, and conclude that I'm suffering rather than I'm a terrible person, that would be more accurate.
I like this. This really also summarizes the theme you've been talking about, that when we're using behaviorism, we're not just kind of taking an answer for whatever it is. We're being curious, asking questions, being with the person, and really doing that precise assessment of their behaviors, not just their actions, but things you can't see, like thoughts and feelings. So I think this is a really important take-home theme for our listeners.
Right.
I want to ask you a little bit now about the when. So any tips or kind of key things to think about with timing and how we would factor in the timing of reinforcers, you know, again, coming back to consistency, and, you know, also coaching parents or other people, caregivers, family members, partners, in how to wait out the time course of extinction burst. So the question here is, what should we think about in terms of when and timing?
So a few things. One is, you know, if when a person's in a highly emotional state, to try to provide a reinforcer in that moment, it may be lost in the storm of the emotion. And so in the height of any highly emotional situation, the idea of trying to do any didactics or any teaching makes zero sense. If your house was burning down and I was trying to teach you French, you'd say, it would make no sense. I mean, because you're freaking out because your house is burning down, and learning French at that moment, you can't think. So if a person's in a lower emotional state, maybe you could do behaviorism. But if they're in a very highly emotional state, but let's just say they were in a highly emotional state, but they were able to be skillful in managing it, you might wait until they're in a lower emotional state, or maybe even the next day, and say, hey, I just want to recognize that that was really difficult and you were still able to manage it. That's got two benefits. One is you're providing a reinforcer at a time when the person's in more receptive to being able to get it. But the other thing is that often people with BPD feel so unseen and so unrecognized, and the idea that you come back to them and say, I did pay attention to what was going on, and I was thinking about you, you know, just reminds them that we often do think about them and that you were able to come back to it. The other thing is that in terms of extinction burst, you know, if you're going to set a plan that you're going to put a behavior on extinction, then you have to, not only you, but everybody else, you know, so if you've got your toddler who wanted to watch Elmo, if your husband then decided that he couldn't stand the screaming and put on the Elmo video, well, then what would happen is that, you know, he was reinforcing the very behavior that you were trying to extinguish, so that you'd all have to be on board with that idea, so that no one reinforces it, so the grandparents don't reinforce them, so that you know, your friends don't reinforce it or anything like that. So an agreement to just write it out and then maybe call each other if you need help in the moment. If you've decided that you're going to give in, then give in very quickly so that you don't then reinforce it at a much higher level. And of course, if something gets really dangerous, you know, in other words, somebody really starts self-injuring badly or something like that, then of course you've got to intervene by calling 911 or something like that. I wouldn't, somebody says, well, I'm going to, you know, do severe self-injury or maybe do suicidal behavior, I wouldn't try to ride that out in terms of an extinction, because of course it could be so dangerous.
Well, this also reminds me, earlier you brought up the phrase catch them being good. So I'm thinking about people involved in the treatment of individuals with BPD. It could be family members, therapists. If this is a higher level of care, like inpatient or residential, it might be milieu staff or counselors. And oftentimes people may report that it's hard to praise someone when they're in this context of of feeling frequently hurt or attacked by the individual with BPD. So what would you say are effective ways to coach these people so that they're motivated to praise these small approximations of the desirable behaviors, even in the context of the ongoing dysregulated behaviors that might not feel good for the individual?
I mean, I think one of the things that I have learned over, 12 years of running 3Es, but certainly 20 years of working with people with BPD, is that I don't, if someone has asthma and they have an asthmatic attack, I don't think that they're doing it to me, or if someone has diabetes and they have high blood sugar, they're not doing it to me. So that when a person with BPD becomes dysregulated and says hurtful things, I just see that as a manifestation of their mental struggle and not as a personal attack. Now, of course, I don't like personal attacks, and I've asked people to leave my room and come back and my office and come back and tell me again. But I just see it as behavior. I don't see it as, okay, that is, personal. But it took me years to realize that that was the case, because otherwise, by not realizing it, then you can hold on to, oh, the person doesn't like me, and they're attacking me, and they're being nasty, and they're being mean and hurtful. And it just alienates the person with BPD further. Often it's just very poor interpersonal effectiveness, and most people with BPD don't want to end up alienating the people that they care about and they love. So that if a milieu counselor or a parent can just recognize that that's just a manifestation of suffering and emotion dysregulation, and that they can ride that out without reacting or just saying, when you use that, I personally don't like it, and it's it pushes me further away from you, so I'm just not going to respond to it. But then when the interactions are better and more effective, then just be able to go back maybe later on in time and say, I really enjoyed that. I really enjoyed spending time with you. I really enjoyed what we did together, something along those lines.
Sometimes these people on the team of individuals with BPD can really be burned out. So I think, ideally you'd be giving someone this message and they're open to hearing it and it works, but I could see it being really hard for milieu staff or even clinicians or family members that have kind of gone through this for years and feel burned out before getting that kind of coaching. I'm curious if that's your experience. Do you run into that?
Yeah, no, it really is. It really is. And I mean, I think especially for young counselors and, people who are mid-career, it does. It feels very unpleasant. And I mean, I think it's important for those of us who are working with colleagues and milieu staff that are, or even families and team members, just to validate, just to recognize how awful it is to have to experience those attacks. But I think also to know that at the same time, know that that does not define the person with borderline personality disorder, that the person with BPD is also, suffering tremendously, and at that moment in time, it's the best that they can do. It's hard to do it when you're on the receiving end of it, I do think that people quit the field of BPD treatment because of this kind of stuff, but I think that over time, people are able to put those behaviors much more in context.
Well, there's a lot here too, because you're also talking about having empathy, and if you're taking it personally and you think it's about you, that could be related to not having empathy for that individual's experience and how emotionally dysregulated they may feel. And so if you're taking it personally, you may have a reaction. And in our society, there's the phrase, even bad attention is attention. And so that could be reinforcing the behavior too. Mm-hmm. So I could see motivating people to not take it personally as a way to bring down their reaction that actually may reinforce the attacks.
But well, and it gets even more, I think, even more fundamental than that. And that is this, is that if a therapist is trying to teach a person with borderline personality disorder that not all attacks are personal and that not everything that happens to them is an indictment of who they are, or that, you know, but I myself cannot do the very thing I'm asking for my patient to do, and I'm the trained professional, well, you know, what hope do they have? So I also think it's a modeling of the behavior.
Beautiful. So another thing about caregivers, so sometimes I think often learning about reinforcement and behaviorism can be empowering, but sometimes caregivers might feel guilty or blame themselves for engaging in reinforcement that they see as causing the teen suffering and problem behaviors. Mm-hmm. So how can we validate and empower caregivers to learn from behaviorism without getting stuck in shame and blame?
Well, you know, first of all, blame is sort of a reappraisal of the past, as if you had the information of the present. If you've got two children,
to teach families. I like that a lot for our listeners to remember as a way to teach blame to families. Yes, keep going.
Yeah, no, because I think when we go back as if we knew, you know, and I mean, which parent wakes up in the morning thinking, how am I going to screw up my kid's life today? No one does, and yet, you know, some people may have, if you have a child who's allergic to peanuts and one who isn't, you know, your child will keep getting reactions to having peanuts until you realize that there's a problem there. And so often, you know, parents are just doing the very best that they can. If they want to blame themselves, that's a behavior that often gets in the way of the child getting better for two reasons. One is because they're spending too much time analyzing what they did wrong, something that they can't change. And then secondly, because they feel guilty, they might not be setting the limits and the consequences that the child needs in order to actually succeed. People make perfect decisions with imperfect information. You're making any decision. You buy a house, you buy a car, you only have the information that you have. You know, and then you discover things along the way. Okay, well, now you have new information. You can make new decisions. So, you know, I think it's important to just, because of course no one would do the things that they did if they knew what the outcome would have been. But often we make those determinations based on the outcome. And we say, well, it was a bad decision because the outcome was bad, but few people go into it with the idea it's going to be a bad outcome.
I like how you're illustrating for us also that DBT assumption that people are doing the best they can. It's they're doing the best they can with the information they have available at that time, not with our crystal ball of seeing into the future.
Exactly. Yeah, and that doesn't mean that we shouldn't keep on learning by being curious, which we ought to. But I think it's the idea that, you know, that spending a lot of time rehashing what one could have done better, especially when what could I have done better when the child was 3 years old? But I mean, the child's 16. You've got the child in your presence right now. This is the child that you have, not the child in the photograph.
Right. Mindfulness is this moment forward too.
Exactly.
So we have very exciting. We have a question from one of our listeners.
Sure.
This listener wrote to us that some patients express great distress at feeling numb and some intense maladaptive behaviors occur to counter the numbness. And we haven't talked about numbness, so I'm really glad she asked.
Mm-hmm.
Often answers to the questions about emotions and thoughts around numbness, especially when they're asked by parents, are some version of I don't know. Mm-hmm. How do you conceptualize this and nudge patients and families past that obstacle?
Well, first of all, the question of I don't know, I mean, there's one of three possibilities I find. It's like if I were to say, what's the square root of 972, you might say, I don't know, because you actually don't know. Sometimes the answer is, I don't know, because I don't want to actually tell you, because every time I tell you, you react in a certain kind of way, and so I don't know is a shortcut for that. But sometimes a person they don't have the language for emotional experiencing. And so it's not that they don't actually know, it's just it's very hard to put into words. If what's happened is they've been punished for sort of any kind of emotional experiencing, then they might not want to talk to the person about it. And I think within DBT, by especially the therapist slowly and meticulously exploring what it is that a person is experiencing, and you know, there's stuff that you can observe. Okay, you know, and that is, it seems to me you're making less eye contact. You're using fewer words, and maybe that's what the numbing experience is. And that with careful and slow exploration of those experiences and validation, that you can often get the person to start talking more. But one of the things that we found is that as patients start to tell us more about their numb experience, for example, I get numb when I become suicidal, but I don't want to talk about it because my parents get so distressed. And then maybe the parent starts to cry, and then the patient will say, well, you see, I'm a terrible person because I made my parent cry, and now I feel guilty that they're suffering. Is an understandable reason why somebody might say, I don't know. So I think that it's possible that someone just doesn't know. It's possible that they just don't want to say, and it's possible that they don't have the words for it. And I think slowly reinforcing more emotional sharing and being less numb. And then the other question that one has to ask is this emotional avoidance because of, you know, maybe comorbid post-traumatic stress disorder, and it's a form of dissociation and not feeling, in which case, you know, you'd want to do exposure treatment or target emotional avoidance.
Thank you for that thoughtful response. It also, again, brings us back to the need for assessment. So we have one last question from one of our listeners. Mm-hmm. So she wrote that she's curious about how to address what we might call contagion and behaviorism. She mentions how this week's Wall Street Journal has an article about one teenager killing themselves and then six more suicides followed. How do you keep an eye on this preventing behavior before it might even show up?
I think a lot of people think that behavior just suddenly shows up out of the blue, and I'm not, you know, it's possible that it can happen that way. It's not my experience that often if we are attuned to other people's typical patterns, so that they do things in a very predictable way, and then they start to deviate from those patterns, that you can get curious. But ultimately, it is, especially the person with BPD, it's their own, you know, ultimate responsibility to be able to pay attention to those things and then to start noticing changes earlier on. And sometimes we'll see that when there is suicidal behavior, it can activate suicidal behavior in other people. But, separating, oh, okay, I wasn't having suicidal thinking, but that person started to talk about it, so I now, it started to generate in me, and separate yourself from it. You can catch that much earlier on, but the truth of the matter is, it is a tragic, tragic state that we live in. I mean, adolescent girl suicides are at all-time highs, boys' suicides are going up, and I think teaching the skills and then applying these much earlier on is going to be critical, because otherwise we're going to see an ongoing rise in behaviors such as suicidality. So I think, again, it's you know, tomorrow's the running of the Boston Marathon. You don't want to start, your first run cannot be in tomorrow's run. You will have had to have trained for it so that when the conditions arise, you're ready for them because you're trained. In the same way, catching those kinds of behaviors earlier on because you've done training in, for example, skills is a way to tackle this problem.
Well, thank you so much for that answer and all your incredibly thoughtful answers. Before we wrap up, was there anything else? I know I've asked you a ton of questions. Is there anything else mm-hmm. you wanted to mention before we finish about behaviorism?
You know, one of the, I suppose I would think about it in this way. I mean, one of the most powerful behaviors that exists is the behavior of connection and the behavior of love. And I mean, we don't, you know, we think about these as emotions, but they are absolutely essential in the healing process. And I think, sadly, a lot of people with BPD often don't feel loved and cared for. And I think that even when things are difficult for those of us who love them, just to remind people with BPD that they are connected, that they are essential, and that they are loved. That over time, you know, if they persist, things will get better.
Wow. So that answer, I think, really was representative of this whole talk, where you gave us a ton of knowledge, a ton of wisdom, and I also think a lot of hope and inspiration. So thank you so much, Blaise, for volunteering, donating your time, and talking with us tonight.
Oh, I really appreciate it. I appreciate the questions. I appreciate the opportunity. I appreciate the NEA BPD, which is just the most wonderful organization. I appreciate everybody with BPDs out there listening and their families who are out there supporting them.
And all our listeners, remember, this is, if you're listening live, this will be archived. It's on iTunes. Please share it. And Blaise, I really think your words will have a ripple effect that will affect a lot of people. So thank you and good night.
Good night. Thanks a lot. Take care. Bye-bye.